Welcome to the South Carolina State Library's podcast, Library Voices SC. I'm Curtis Rogers, Communications Director, and today I'm pleased to have with us in the studio Dr. Ed Madden. Dr. Madden is a poet, activist, professor of English, and director of Women's and Gender Studies at the University of South Carolina. He is the author of Signals, which won the 2007 South Carolina Poetry Book Prize, and Prodigal Variations, Nest, Arc, and he recently edited Theologies of Terrain by Tim Conroy. His chapbook, My Father's House, was selected for the Seven Kitchens Press Editors Series, and his poems have appeared in Best New Poets 2007, the Book of Irish American Poetry, and in journals such as Prairie Schooner, Crazy Horse, Poetry Ireland Review, Los Angeles Review, and online at the Good Men Project. He's also the first poet laureate of Columbia, South Carolina. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I was looking through all of your accolades, and I was like, I don't have this much paper to because you've also, I remember as having been on the board of the South Carolina Academy of Authors, you were also a winner for the Academy of Authors, the poetry contest.
Yeah.
I think that was 2010.
I think so. Yeah,
back.
The
Carrie Nickens McRae.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was the inaugural winner.
Yep. It's great to have you here, and I want to talk, because you have such a broad range of stuff, but what first drew you to poetry? What's kind of like maybe your earliest memory or maybe thought process about poetry?
I used to joke when people asked me, when did you start writing, that kind of thing, and I used to say, when did you stop? Because I like to think, this may be a fiction I hold in my head, but I like to think that lots of kids take pleasure in language, take pleasure in language play. And so I was always writing. I remember in high school writing poems that I have copies of now and I think are dreadful, but I just kept writing. When I went to a high school reunion once, I ran into one of my high school, my senior English teacher, Mrs. Miller, whom I adored, and she, 10th grade English teacher. I think of her as senior because she also was the sponsor for the yearbook. Anyway, I told her I thought those poems were awful, and why was she so nice about them? And she said, you were writing what you thought poetry should be. You just didn't know yet what it was. And I thought, well, that was very sweet.
That is a nice sentiment.
Yeah. So, but I guess I've just always been writing. I was always a very bookish kid.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, probably to the great embarrassment of my parents, I would take a book to Thanksgiving, and while everybody else was either eating or watching football, I was in a corner of the room reading some book.
I can relate to that, because one year at Christmas in Jacksonville, Florida, visiting relatives, my mother said, what are you reading? And I said, E. It's just, that was the volume of the encyclopedia. So yeah. I can really relate. After getting into poetry, like maybe in high school, did you continue that route? Because
I continued to write, and there weren't any creative writing classes really in my undergraduate school. But then when I went to grad school in English, there was an MFA program at the University of Texas, and I wasn't officially in the program, but students who were writers could take workshops as electives as long as they had the permission of the instructor. So during my whole time at the University of Texas in Austin, I would take creative writing workshops, poetry workshops for my elective classes. And I persisted.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept writing and kept sending stuff out.
And so that's what brings you pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I work things out.
The interesting thing to me is that you're also Columbia, South Carolina's first poet laureate. How did all that come about? And I see you brought in a resolution.
Right. So there were a group of arts organizers here in the city, Cindy Boyder from the Jasper Project being one, Lee Snellgrove from One Columbia for Arts and History. And they put together a committee to work on this project and worked with the city council. So in October of 2014, the city council passed a resolution creating the position and the parameters of the position and the expectations of the position.
And the huge salary?
Yeah, there's no, I'll go ahead and state that up front. There's no salary for this position. There is a small budget for projects, though. So I do have a small budget to cover, you know, like when we did coffee sleeves last year for, or 2 years ago for National Poetry Month. So we do have a small budget to cover projects. But anyway, that was 2014. They put together a committee. Cindy was on it. Lee was on it. I think Nikki Finney was on it. I'm not sure who else, but anyway, in that they had a application process that was nominated. I had to turn in materials. So anyway, I was selected as the first one. It's a 4-year term.
Okay.
It is renewable. And it was the first city laureate position in the state.
Okay.
Since then, Edgefield created one. Aiken has created one. Charleston has created one, and Marcus Amaker is the new poet laureate there, and he's amazing. He's just a dynamo creating projects and doing things with kids. And I know that Greenville is thinking about creating a position as well, but this was the first one in the state. We have a state laureate, and we've had a state laureate for a long time, but this is the first
that's
city
Marjorie
laureate.
Wentworth. That's right. That's wonderful. Columbia is a trendsetter.
For South Carolina.
Yeah.
There are lots of city laureates around the nation.
Okay.
Differing terms, differing expectations. I had read a piece in the New York Times, and I love what I think it was a mayor, a California mayor, said that she expected the poet laureate to sing a community's virtues and to plumb its psyche. And I love that phrase, that part of your job as a poet is to examine the psyche of your own community, and be a kind of public voice for your community. The expectations of the position are pretty clear. You're expected to write poems, for example, all 3 years, the State of the City Address, Mayor Benjamin's State of the City Address, I've read a poem.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked to write a poem for the commemoration of the burning of Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And then occasionally other groups have asked me, so Benedict College, they at their Black History Month dinner, I did a poem for them my first year. South Carolina Gay Pride asked me to write a poem for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 years in a row, I've read at the Gervais Street Bridge dinner as well. So go to schools and libraries when they invite you. Write poems as requested by the city for special occasions. And also just promote poetry among young people. Beyond that, I've worked with Lee Snellgrove a lot to think about promoting poetry as a public art. And I've also tried to come up with various ways to create venues for South Carolina writers, and particularly Columbia and Midlands writers. So, for example, 2 years we've had poetry on all those city buses, which was kind of the first public arts project I thought of, that any major city, you know, London, Dublin, Washington, D.C.,
sure. They
have poems on the subway or on the bus system. So we've done that twice, and we're going to do it again next year. And if I could go ahead and put it in a plug, next year's poems for the buses, the deadline is February 15th.
Mm-hmm.
They need to send them to edward.madden@gmail.com.
We'll add a link on the page.
Okay. Or they can send them through the Poet Laureate site. There's a Poet Laureate website.
That's the ColumbiaPoet.org?
ColumbiaPoet.org.
Okay.
And the first year, our theme was the story of the city, so it could be any stories of what Columbia was to you. The second year, our theme was rivers.
Mm-hmm.
And then this year, our theme is going to be two cities. I want our poems to sort of work with the Nickelodeon's film festival, which is on two cities, and thinking about the difference between Maine and North Maine. So thinking about, I guess I want poems that either are thinking about the things in the city that unite us as a city, but also the things that divide us geographically, racially, economically in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And I want poems that can do that in 12 lines or fewer.
Wow.
Bus poems have to be short.
That's a lot to ask.
And then what we do, they'll go on the buses. The first year we also put together a little book and had a reading. And we even had a traveling reading on the 101 Main Street bus.
Mm-hmm.
So we had some poets who volunteered to read aloud, and so passengers were getting on thinking, what in the world is this?
How was it received?
They clapped. They loved it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so it was kind of fun. The second year, we tweeted them out once a day, the whatever the image was, the way they're formatted for the bus, mm-hmm. we would tweet and Facebook those images out once a day for the whole month of April for National Poetry Month. And we'll probably do the same thing again this year.
Okay.
Sorry, I can rattle on and on. Other sort of...
Oh, no. It's like, you've even got the poetry project that you did with the parking tickets.
Yeah, I think that's my favorite so far of the kind of public poems we've done. So I... we did not tell the city we were going to do this. Lee Snellgrove and I solicited poems on cars or parking or traffic from poets all over the state. Mm-hmm. So this was it wasn't just a Columbia Writers. I was trying to reach statewide. I picked six. They did not know what was going to happen. But then we formatted them, and Lee Snellgrove at One Columbia did a beautiful job because they look like real parking tickets.
Mm-hmm, they really
even
do.
He even has the seal of the city of Columbia on them. Sorry, I have to look at this to make sure I read it correctly. And it says, a project of the Columbia Poet Laureate, Happy April Fools. So we did it on April 1st, which was perfect this year because it was a Saturday. So it's April Fool's Day. It's mm-hmm. the beginning of National Poetry Month. But Saturdays, they don't ticket downtown.
Right.
So it was the perfect occasion. And it was a beautiful day, so Soda City Market was jammed. It mm-hmm. was packed. So we had six poets, six different parking tickets, and we distributed, I think, around 2,500 tickets.
I even got one.
We sort of blanketed downtown two mm-hmm. or three times. I had students who volunteered and people with One Columbia, and Tim Conroy came along. He was one of the poets mm-hmm. we used. So we blanketed all around downtown two or three times, and we did the two big parking garages as well. Mm-hmm. And then a little after lunch, you know, we lost our volunteers. People were getting tired and hot. So Bert, my partner, and I took them, and we went and did the Vista twice. Mm-hmm. And then we thought, we'll just go around elsewhere downtown. So we thought it would be fun. So we did ticket Senate Street and all around the State Library as well. And we went around USC campus and ticketed as well. And I even made sure to go behind the president's house so he got ticketed too.
Oh, perfect.
So and we got such great social media. People were posting on Facebook and on Instagram.
Oh, yeah.
And
there was I think I took a picture of mine and posted it on Facebook or something.
That was a fun project.
Yeah, it's really a great way to, to get people who may not be interested in poetry or may not even think about poetry to actually look critically at something because they think it's something else. And then it's like you trick them into reading a poem.
Yeah, I also think it's kind of cool for the poets. I mean, one of their publications now is a parking ticket poem.
Right.
Or 2 years ago, April 2015, I asked for poems about rivers because to go along with the bus project mm-hmm. as well, and we put them on coffee sleeves. We hand stamped 800 coffee sleeves that went to the independent coffee shops, the two drips mm-hmm. and the two wired goats. Okay. And there were, we did six poems there, no, eight poems there. And a range of, they were all Midlands writers, but I got a range of writers. People who are academic writers, people who are spoken word writers. One beautiful spoken word piece by someone whose house had been destroyed by the flood. Mm. Anyway, so those were on coffee sleeves. So all mm-hmm. during the month of April, National Poetry Month of that year, if you bought coffee at Drip or at Wired Goat, you got a coffee sleeve with a poem on it. And then 2 years in a row, too. So that year, 2016, I'm sorry, that was 16. 2015 was my first year as poet laureate. 2016... we also took those poems and sent them to the Nickelodeon. So the film festival that year was on the river. Okay. And so they posted the poems on the screen in between screenings of films. Mm-hmm. So the six river poems that were on coffee sleeves were also that April being shown at the Nickelodeon. And then this past year, the Nickelodeon, the film festival was Visiones. Mm-hmm. And so I solicited poems from Spanish language writers in both Spanish and English, and a couple in Spanglish. Mm-hmm. And Vera Gomez from Greenville helped me curate the series. And so we chose, I think, eight poems from Spanish language writers across the state that, again, were on the screen at the Nickelodeon between screenings of films.
That's amazing. That's just such a great project. One of the things that you've kept on saying is the word river. And one of the things that when I went to the ColumbiaPoet.org website, you had a poem that I really liked, and I was wondering if you would read that for us. And it's it was done at the Gervais Street Bridge Dinner this past October.
Right. Yeah, so twice I've been asked to read poems at the Gervais Street Bridge Dinner.
And what is that dinner for people who don't know?
Oh, it's a super thing. They shut down the bridge between Columbia and West Columbia on a Sunday night. It's tables set for 1,000 people.
Wow.
It's happened for 3 years in a row, and they have different charities or foundations that they give money to. For example, the first year, Riverkeeper was one of the mm-hmm. charities that they had designated.
And Columbia does have an official Riverkeeper.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, look up their website. They do amazing work. And in fact, they're the ones who are currently suing about the toxic sludge that's at the bottom of the river.
Mm.
So anyway, the second year I wrote one, I wrote one about the flood. But this year, I wasn't sure what to write. Tom Hall, who helps organize the dinner, called me and said, we need you to write a poem.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Hall asks you to do something, you usually do it. And so I wasn't sure what to write, but I called the Riverkeeper, Bill Stangler, just for suggestions for things to look at or think about. And looked, they have a beautiful film about the river on their website. So I watched that. And then I was also reading John Lane's book.
Mm-hmm. He's up in Spartanburg, isn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, but he has a beautiful book about boating down the rivers of South Carolina all the way to the sea. And so mm-hmm. there's a section where he comes through Columbia. And I was struck by one thing he talked about. He talked about how beautiful the bridge is right there over the Congaree. That it was a big deal to mm-hmm. cross over from one place to another. And so mm-hmm. the bridge sort of says that because it's so beautifully done. So anyway, this is the poem. It's called Crossing. I wrote it for the 2017 Gervais Street Bridge Dinner, and I've dedicated it to John Lane, who writes about our rivers, and to Congaree Riverkeeper Bill Stangler, who protects them. Back then, crossing over was an event. The bridge told you so, its arches and fancy lanterns. Time moved on below you. Crossing over meant becoming someone, a different being, headed to a different place. Of course, Sherman had burned an earlier one. Back then, you could get off the trolley at the Richland end of the Gervais Street Bridge, walk up the canal to Irwin Park on Laurel with its tiny zoo and its view of the state penitentiary, a park blacks could use only on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So many ways to lock things up, block things off. Like dropping rocks on the toxic sludge of coal tar that leaked back then and now lines the river bottom from here down to Blossom. Turn the tap and take a glass of water. Imagine it, the whole watershed distilled into 8 clear ounces in your hand, filtered first by the mussels before it ever reaches a treatment plant, the slab shells and hill splitters, the pink-rayed fat mucket. Upstream, rivers of traffic now converge on the I-26 bridge, slow down to sluggish in the daily rush, and we're lucky if we even turn soon enough to see the great blue heron, like an origami trick, a cantankerous kite unfolding itself into flight against the sky.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
And I really like how, you know, it fits in with the fact that you're the poet laureate of the city, is that there are some specific street names and things that, you know, people who live in Columbia would know the references to.
And bits of history that they might not know, like mm-hmm. the fact that there used to be a little park and a little zoo, mm-hmm. And black people were only allowed to use it twice a week, and so little things like that as well.
It is. It's really, really cool.
Thanks.
In other aspects of your poetry and your work that may fit into, you know, poet laureate work or even activism, what other kinds of things with poetry do you do?
That's such a broad question. I've had two books published since I've become laureate, and one is my fourth full-length book. It's a book I really, really am invested in and emotionally. It's called ARC. It came out last year. When my father was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, I moved home to help take care of him. And so the book is based in that. It's a kind of memoir in verse, a memoir in poetry about taking care of my dad in his last 3.5 months of living with cancer. So that book means a lot to me. And then just this year, I had a little chapbook published, just this month, a little chapbook published by Seven Kitchens Press. It won the Robin Becker Prize. It's called So They Can Sing. It won the Robin Becker Prize, which is a national prize for gay and lesbian poetry. Mm-hmm. And it's a tiny little chapbook filled with poems about flowers and marriage and tadpoles. And there's a whole sequence about Charles Darwin, a whole sequence called Urban Ornithomancies, because I love the word ornithomancy.
if you can say it.
it means telling the future, telling fortunes, divination on the basis of bird flight and bird song.
Oh, wow.
So it's a poem full of birds.
So it
was a fun little book to put together.
So with both of these, you've got ARC and then you've got So They Can Sing. What do the titles mean?
So ARC, when my dad was dying, we moved him from the hospital home that spring, and it was a spring of floods. It was flooding all around. And so I was in this house with my mom and my dad, and we're thinking about survival. We're thinking, how long can he live? You know, we're taking care of him. I don't know. So I was just struck by the fact that here we are, this little house, this little craft surrounded by water. Even briefly, it was flooded so much around the house that the hospice nurse wouldn't bring her car through. So I have to go out in a big four-wheel drive truck and pick her up on the highway to bring her in for her daily visits. So I actually opened the book with a little tiny poem called ARC. Which is about my favorite toy as a kid, which was my little Noah's Ark. And so there are lots of poems, too, about animals in there, because the weird thing, when it floods, of course, animals are where they aren't supposed to be. So we had snakes in the front yard, we had armadillos, we had mice, we had bear tracks in a field out in front of the house.
Wow.
So all those things come in the poem as well. And then the publisher that took it, Sibling Rivalry Press, who've been just a delight to work with, they're based in Arkansas, and I was the first. I was born and raised in Arkansas, and this happened in Arkansas, and I was the first Arkansas poet that they had ever published.
Oh, really?
So for them, ARC also carried the resonance of it being an Arkansas story.
Oh, cool.
So that's why. I can read the opening poem if you
want. Yeah, that would be wonderful.
About my favorite toy, my little Noah's Ark.
In fact, I went to that book launch and I remembered you had a little plastic Noah's Ark.
I bought it on eBay. I thought, I need a little Noah's Ark. I couldn't find the exact one I had as a kid, but I found one very similar. So on the food table,
cool.
There was a little
I remembered Noah's seeing Ark. It and I put two and two together.
So, ARC, Christmas, 1966. The small box is filled with little beasts, a barn that's a barge, a boat, the ark's ridge sides like boards, a plastic plank, a deck that drops in fitted slots, but lifted reveals that zoo of twos, heaped beasts to be released beneath a glittering tree, its dove-clipped limbs. Dad's asleep in his reclining seat, and crumpled waves of paper recede as Mom circles the room. The humming wheel throws light across the walls. I like this poem. It's so sonically thick, it's almost hard to read. And then, that last image probably dates me. So the humming wheel throwing light on the walls, it's a color wheel. So my rainbow at the end is the color wheel on the Christmas tree throwing splashing light across the walls.
The tinfoil Christmas tree. My grandmother had one of those.
Grandmother had one. I mean, I'm actually collapsing two stories. We always had a real tree, but my grandmother had the fake one with the color wheel. So I thought, that's my rainbow. I have to have that color wheel there at the end of the poem.
Very cool. And then your recent chat book, So They Can Sing, what's that title about?
There's the long sequence in the middle of the book. I did a sequence of poems, some short poems that I put together in this, and then there are little bits that are reflecting on Charles Darwin. So the poem's called Adapted in the Most Perfect Manner to Each Other, or Reading Darwin. So Adapted in the Most Perfect Manner to each other was a phrase he used about the evolutionary adaptation between flowers and the insects that pollinate them. So there are lots of flowers and bits about Darwin and language from Darwin. But at the end, I have this image of we left a wheelbarrow out in the rain one spring, and then we couldn't flip it over because it was full of frog eggs. And then it was full of tadpoles. So we couldn't flip it. We wanted to keep all the little froggies. So so at the end of the poem, it says, when they lose their tails, their mouths get bigger so they can eat. No, so they can sing. So I mean, technically their mouths get bigger so they can eat, but no, I want it to be so they can sing. So that's where the title comes from, so they can sing.
That's a great image. I can just see that wheelbarrow.
So that, this book is very much about nature and relationships. And it has one of my favorite poems I've ever written in it, which was a love poem to my partner before marriage was available. And so it's called My Husband Who Is Not My Husband.
Shall I read it? Go ahead.
I love this poem. So, my husband who is not my husband. His priestly gestures consecrating the broken eggs, hands moving over the stove, slabs of meat skittering in grease, drop biscuits big as a cat's head threaded with cheese. Him making the fountain, making lantana, acanthus, making bloom and ripple, song, making the birds. My husband, the blue room, the bright room, best china, best silver lifted from a box in the closet, its red beds of best silver put back later for later. My husband, who is not my husband, who is still mine, see him crying in the Dublin airport. He doesn't want you to see. Can you see the euchomus, its waxy leaves, its stalk blossoming in the hot sun, pushing up among the marigolds? Scars from this or that on shin or back, wrist or hand, the way the garden loves him, the bees, him among the lilies, his hands lilies, his mouth a twist of quince, his scent. My husband among the lilies. My husband sauntering down the aisles, him sauntering down the aisles at the flea market, dust settling on everything, his small flashlight, his blue eyes, his sound of geese, a train. Look, something glitters and is gone. My husband, the gold in the leaves falling, and him, a coverlet of mulch across the beds or asleep, the heat of him, the hot water bottle of him, the cat purring at our feet. My husband, who is not my husband, who is still mine, the blue walls say so, the orchid deciding to bloom again.
Wow, got a lot of images out of that.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. One of the other things I wanted to chat about with you was your connection to Ireland, because I know you've been there a lot, and you've, there was also, let's see, you had gotten some poems published in, was it the Book of Irish American Poetry and also Poetry Ireland Review? What's your connection with Ireland?
And my third book, Nest, actually was published by an Irish publisher, Salmon Crest.
All right.
Published the third book. My field of study as a graduate student was late 19th, early 20th century British poetry, but the two chapters of what eventually my dissertation, what eventually became a book, the two chapters that I most liked were the ones about Irish writers or Irish and an Irish American writer. And so my my research just began to focus more and more on Irish writers, Irish poetry. And so ever since I've been at the University of South Carolina, I've taught Irish literature classes, and my research has focused more and more on Irish writing. And so I've been, and I've also been just extraordinarily lucky since 2008 to every year have some kind of funding or fellowship that let me go over at least once a year.
Wow, that is great.
Yeah, so I mean, that's 7 years of always getting to go over. I was a research fellow at the National University of Ireland in Galway in the spring of 2010. I got a fellowship to study contemporary Irish theater in I think the fall of 2009, when Maynooth University received the papers of Pierce Hutchinson, a poet I really love, when they received his papers, they did a application for a writer to come be the for the first scholar to come look at the papers. So I'm a real archive nerd, and so this idea, I just love this. So I applied and got it. So I was the first scholar to be able to go through the poet Pierce Hutchinson's manuscripts and papers and personal letters.
Wow.
In Maynooth University. That was the summer, May of 2015, I think. And the way it was set up, you had 2 weeks to just root around in the archives, and then there was the first Pierce Hutchinson symposium Maynooth University was hosting that May. And the idea was you would write a paper that would then be the keynote at the symposium. So it was an amazing opportunity. And I loved that kind of research, like reading old papers and letters. And, oh man, I really am an archive nerd. I mean, in two ways. One is I love working in archives. When I was working on my dissertation, I got a fellowship to go to the British Library and go through the journals of Michael Field. Mm-hmm. Michael Field was the pen name of two women, probably a lesbian couple, who were writing together as under a male pen name. And I got to go through their journals, and it was. Gosh, I can't think how to describe how exciting it is to me to sit in a library and read a diary from the 1800s. And I was in it so much I started to figure out whose handwriting, because they wrote together in the same diary. So I started to be able to figure out whose handwriting was whose. And I just love that kind of work. And then I think I'm also an archive nerd in another way, in that I collect stuff. I mean, my grandma was a pack rat too, so I get this genetically. But I keep stuff, knowing that when I retire or die, I'm just going to get this huge trove of weird magazines and pamphlets and ephemera and
for the
books,
next
nobody,
archive nerd to go through.
Yeah. So I remember once I had a fellowship. This was 2016. At the London School of Economics, they've got a huge gay and lesbian archive, the Hall Carpenter Archive. And I was working on a writer, Colum Clifford, who gaelicized his name to Colum O'Cluven. He was a poet and a playwright. He left Ireland in part so he could be openly gay in London, and in part because his family had disowned him. So he took off for London. None of his plays have ever been published, but I found that some of his work was in someone else's collection, so some other hoarder, pack rat like me, kept everything and then donated it to the London School of Economics. And so they had some stuff. So I had so much fun, because not only did I get to find scripts that he had written or collaborated on, and even set designs for plays that had never been, never been published, but political buttons, his diary full of weird political stickers, a play of his own father's. So his father, Sigurdsson Clifford, was a playwright. So the one play he had kept of his, which made me wonder why this play. I love feeling like you're finding things that other people don't know about, that you can use, that you can say something about, and also just like that feeling of being immersed in someone else's life, someone else's culture, someone else's ethos and history and material stuff. Anyway, sorry, I go on.
No, that's,
I love
that's,
that kind of work.
Well, that made me think as you're talking about that. And again, this is Library Voices South Carolina. And so we like to, talk a little bit about libraries and archives. But what maybe was your experience as a child with libraries?
There was a county library in my hometown, Newport, Arkansas, and my mother got us library cards, and we went all the time. And I would come home with this huge stack of books. that was one of my favorite places. Because we lived 15, 20 minutes out in the country, I didn't have the experience of like going to a library frequently in the way that I think kids who grow up in the city might. But we went as often as we could. And it was a great place. It was a great place.
A lot of memories from those kind of experiences.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough in part of my growing up to live across the street from our public library. So that was really neat. What I think would be interesting is to know kind of what you are going to be working on in the coming months. What are you going to be working on, professionally as far as with your work at USC, but also with, Poet Laureate activities, any other kinds of activities?
So for Poet Laureate, this is the end of my term. This year is. We're doing bus poems again, so I'll be working on that. The deadline is February 15th if anybody wants to submit a poem. And those, I'll be going through those. We're going to put, this year for National Poetry Month, we're going to put up banners on Main Street with quotes from mostly historical South Carolina poets, but some contemporary poets as well. So I'm working on that right now. I've got to pick the quotes we're going to use on those banners, but I thought that would be a cool way to celebrate National Poetry Month. I keep trying to think of other... I worked with Luke Hodges, was an intern at Nickelodeon and at One Columbia, who worked with me one semester, and we just kind of brainstormed crazy, we call them guerrilla poetry ideas. So I'm hoping to come up with another crazy one, like the parking tickets or the coffee sleeves, something else that we might try this year, but I don't know yet what that will be. I am hosting an Irish Studies conference at USC.
Oh, really?
In March. So I'll be working on that a lot the next 3 months. Our keynotes, interestingly enough, our theme is archives.
Oh.
So how do you tell the story of Ireland from different archives? So one of our keynotes is Sean Kennedy from St. Mary's University in Halifax, who's a Beckett scholar, but has written a lot about Beckett's politics based not on his published writing, but on things he's found in Beckett archives. And the other one will be Paula Feldman from here at the University of South Carolina, who recently published a collection of poems by Mary Tighe. She's a 19th century Irish writer, poet, not very well known. So, I mean, this is one of the things Paula does amazingly well, which is bring back women's voices, particularly women whose work deserves to be read and remembered, but who have not been. And so she and her collaborator, Brian Cooney, who was her grad student at the time, now teaches somewhere in the Northwest, but they're going to talk about their work in putting together this collection and finding work in the archives. And it's interesting because I announced that theme. I've gotten all sorts of quirky and lovely little proposals from people about, I remember one's about a guy who worked in a Jesuit archive and the crazy historical stuff he found there. I have a woman from Charleston who works on the history of abortion in Ireland, which is interesting because we tend to think of it being such a Catholic country, and it's literally against their constitution at the moment. They have a right to life amendment in their constitution, Amendment 8, which they have a public referendum on next year probably. But she's going to talk about the archives of women's practices that we know working with abortifacients and homemade abortion, not homemade, what's the word? But anyway, so she's going to talk about the kind of hidden history of that based on her archival work. So just lots of fascinating papers.
Yeah. And do you have a website for the conference?
Or? We will. Right now there's just a call for papers through the conference's website at USC. But yeah, we don't yet, but we will.
And what's it called so people can just Google
it? It's the American Conference for Irish Studies Southern Region. So the American Conference for Irish Studies is the national organization, and we're hosting the Southern meeting.
Great. So in wrapping up, I would love to hear another poem from you if you have one that you would like to read.
If it's okay, I'll read another poem from Arc. There's one poem from this book. When I would talk about helping take care of my dad, I would tell a story about him and about the experience. And then a hospice nurse gave me another way of telling the story. And I guess I like this poem because either way can be true. I actually had, I gave a presentation, I don't remember what college I was at, but I gave a reading from this, and a student asked me which one was true. And I said, I don't know. I think the point of the poem is that we learn how we can tell stories differently. Anyway, so this is the poem. It's called Thirst. The nurse said, "Your father really looks at you when you walk into the room. He stares at you," she said. "He must have something to tell you, but he never tells you." Later, another hospice worker listened to this story. She said, "No, you know, sometimes as we're leaving this world, our world contracts to the small space of the room, to the few things we love. Your father wasn't looking at you because he had something to tell you. No, he was looking at you because he loved you, she said. It was near the end, she said. He was drinking you in.
Wow, that's great.
Thanks.
Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting me. This was great fun.